It won't be easy tabulating the cost of the natural disaster in Japan.
But it might well be the most expensive natural disaster ever.
Marketplace Midday Update is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From APM, American Public Media in Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Steve Chiatakis. Thanks for checking out the podcast from Marketplace.org. Today is Wednesday, March 23rd. Coming up, Egypt's stock exchange is reopened for business. Healthcare reform turns one. Where's the birthday cake?
And the Venezuelan president pondering life on other planets. That's later on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Don't miss the numbers, the news, and Kai's final note. Subscribe to the Marketplace podcast. Find it on iTunes or online at marketplace.org/podcasts.
Japan's government said today the earthquake and tsunami there could cost the country $309 billion. That's more than twice the cost of damage from Hurricane Katrina. The U.S. is stepping in to help, and we continue our coverage now of the human and economic toll of the tragedy in Japan with our Asia Bureau Chief, Rob Schmitz, who joins us now from Tokyo. Hi, Rob.
Hey, Jeremy.
So how much is the United States doing to help Japan?
Well, this has been one of the U.S. military's largest relief efforts in years. I mean, you've got 20 U.S. Navy ships off Japan's northern coast right now, including one of our aircraft carriers. And the Navy's managed to deliver 200,000 pounds of crucial supplies like food and water to victims of the tsunami. The estimated cost of the entire cleanup of these areas is now at more than $200 billion. But I think a lot of Japanese are paying attention to the U.S. efforts. Here's an example. Today, I was interviewing a factory manager in Tokyo about the impact of this crisis on his business. And in the middle of the interview, he started to cry. And here's some sound effects. And while he was crying, he bowed to me, and it was one of those prolonged bows. I mean, because I'm American, he was thanking me for all the help the United States is extending to Japan in the relief effort.
So very grateful for the help, Rob. Are people getting everything that they need?
Well, while I was in Sendai last week, I saw the evacuation centers were really lacking food. And I should add that the U.S. military presence has always been controversial in Japan. But here, the U.S. stepped in when Japan's own government had problems doing so. People have noticed that, and it's a good bet public opinion toward the U.S. presence here may change as a result.
Marketplace's Rob Schmitz in Tokyo. Thanks, Rob.
Thanks, Jeremy.
Tokyo health officials said today radiation levels are higher in the water supply there. Now, those officials are recommending people not give tap water to infants. The water warning comes after some locally grown foods turned up with higher levels of radiation, and people are starting to wonder if there is any relief in sight. Yumiko Ono is managing editor of the Wall Street Journal's Japanese website, and she's with us now from Tokyo. Thanks for being with us.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
Now, Tokyo authorities are saying that infants shouldn't drink the tap water, but you have a kid, right?
Yeah, I have a 4-year-old, not exactly an infant, and no longer on formula, of course, but nonetheless, it is of concern. You start asking a whole bunch of questions. What does it mean that infants can't drink the water, but it's safe for adults? What will happen to you if you drink the water accidentally? So I won't be surprised if some people, just to be safe, even if they're adults, would go out and buy bottled water. The government is already asking people not to go rush to the stores and try to hoard bottled water in case there's a shortage.
Has that happened? Is there bottled water readily available still?
I don't know for sure, but there are lots of people on Twitter saying, oh, I'm going to go get my water now. Oh, we thought the milk was back after, you know, we couldn't get milk for a few days. And now it's water. What should we do?
Are you concerned it's going to get any worse?
You know, one thing I really want to know is the whole big picture. Right now, we're getting little bits of information every day from the government. You know, then it's the vegetables, now it's the water. You know, you sort of want to know, are things getting worse or better?
What's it like covering this story from Tokyo at the same time that you live there in the city?
Mm-hmm. It's very stressful in many ways. Everything is adding to the stress. For a while, this radiation issue seemed like it was getting worse and worse, with white smoke and black smoke coming out, the cooling not happening, you know, the spraying of the water. So every day, we are braced for more bad news or some new bad news. And I could see how the stress is getting to people. It's not an easy time.
Yumiko Ono, managing editor of the Wall Street Journal's Japanese website. Thank you so much. Take care, stay safe, and keep those kids safe, too.
Thank you.
Because of the earthquake and tsunami, Toyota says it's delaying the Japanese launch of its new Prius minivan and wagon. Tokyo shares fell 1.5%, and most Asian stocks were lower.
The number of buyers of new homes plunged in February to the fewest number on records, and that dates back nearly 50 years. That's another sign that it's a dismal and weak housing market. The Commerce Department says new home sales fell nearly 17% last month. Looking for more numbers? They're all at our website, marketplace.org.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Wednesday, March 23rd. I'm Steve Chiotakis. You can follow me on Twitter at Radio Chio.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson on Twitter as well, at Jeremy Hobson. Now let's get to the global perspective. What's happening in business and economics at the intersection of the U.S. and the rest of the world?
It's been a couple of months since mass protests rocked Egypt, ousted its government, and shut down the stock market there. But the exchange was opened today amid fears if it had stayed closed much longer, it would have affected foreign investment. The BBC's Jonathan Head is with us from Cairo with the latest. Hi, Jonathan.
Nice to be with you, Steve.
The market is dropping lots. Is that because people don't think the new Egyptian government will be good for business?
I don't think it's that, Steve. I think it's simply that when you shut a stock market for 8 weeks during the most turbulent period in a country's history, you know, there's an awful lot of selling pressure in there. People who would have wanted to sell couldn't. They piled on their orders this morning. We had a 10% drop in the space of just a minute. And now, under new rules, they've suspended trading for half an hour. Everybody expected there'd be a big drop. But clearly, there's an awful lot of uncertainty about where Egypt goes from here. I don't think anybody except a very brave investor is ready to jump in right yet.
It's been weeks and weeks since the tumult on the streets of Egypt. Why did it take so long for the stock market to reopen?
Well, they planned to reopen it, but they kept delaying. It's been delayed five times. There were a number of reasons. Clearly, they were very nervous about panic selling. They wanted to get measures in place that would limit that. They've got those in. They were also concerned they didn't want people accused of corruption under President Mubarak, who had been investigated, to go and take their vast sums of money out. So that was a good reason for freezing the markets. They also wanted measures to protect smaller investors.
The BBC's Jonathan Head in Cairo. Jonathan, thank you.
Thank you very much, Steve.
Let's get some more analysis now from economist Richard DeKayser with the Parthenon Group. He's with us every Wednesday from Boston. Hi, Richard.
Good morning.
So does it really help to keep a stock market closed for 2 months if when you open it, it's just going to drop like this?
No, I don't think so. The standard argument is that you provide a pause if markets aren't assimilating information quickly and efficiently. You give people a time to absorb new information, and
right.
With that information, people behave more rationally.
Well, do you think that now they have the information? Are things more certain now in Egypt than they were a couple months ago?
I would argue that they are not. We have some certainty on the political situation. Mubarak, his regime is over, and some form of representative democracy is going to be taking shape. But economic uncertainties are still enormous. The military was a major force in the Egyptian economy, and there are signs that maybe they're even rolling back rather than advancing reforms. And certainly, if we look around the neighborhood, tumult is everywhere in the Middle East. Its neighbor, Libya, and not so far away, Yemen, are arguably in some form of revolution. So I would say uncertainty is not diminished overall.
Richard DeKayser, economist at the Parthenon Group, thanks so much as always.
My pleasure.
In Portugal, a budget vote today to reduce the country's debt could force the prime minister to resign. Now, if the government does fail, that pushes Portugal one step closer to a massive European bailout. The latest from Marketplace Europe correspondent Stephen Beard.
The Portuguese government has been struggling to reduce its budget deficit. So far, it has failed. The latest measure is the fourth attempt in less than a year. The plan to raise taxes and cut public spending is deeply unpopular. Lawmakers are thought likely to reject it today. And if they do, the Prime Minister says he'll resign. Kevin Dunning of the Economist Intelligence Unit says investors may then stop buying Portuguese government bonds.
I think the situation is going to wind up that Portugal ends up seeking a bailout from its European partners in the same manner that Ireland and Greece had to.
This would be a further setback for the group of countries that use the euro. The Portuguese crisis would inflict maximum embarrassment. Tomorrow, European leaders meet for a major summit to approve a new beefed-up euro bailout fund. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Oil is back up around $105 a barrel today. I say dollars because that's the currency that's used to buy and sell oil around the world. But the dollar spot as the dominant global currency is being challenged. We continue our Economy 4.0 series on the new global economy now with this report from special correspondent David Brancaccio.
The dollar at numero uno for the last 70 years or so brings special benefits our way. Foreigners like to save in dollars, demand that keeps our interest rates down. Converting currency is expensive, and American companies have the advantage of not switching if an international deal is done in dollars. But that's changing.
At the end of last year, there were 70,000 Chinese companies that were doing their cross-border trade using China's own currency, which meant that the foreign company on the other side of the deal was accepting Chinese currency in payment.
Barry Eichengreen, an economist at UC Berkeley, has a new book about the dollar called Exorbitant Privilege. That's the phrase coined years ago by a French official annoyed by the dollar advantage. But the current rise in deals done in Chinese renminbi is just one sign its star is rising quickly.
So you may have heard that the Bank of China started offering Chinese currency deposits to Americans.
Well, there it is on Madison Avenue, the Bank of China USA. All I need is a couple of forms of ID, a social security card, and at least $500, and I can become an international currency speculator.
If you want to take a bet that the Chinese currency is going to gain value relative to the dollar over time, you can do that now.
And deposits in the new Bank of China New York account are FDIC insured. U.S.-based EverBank also has a renminbi account, but with a minimum deposit of $10,000. EverBank's Chuck Butler.
The Chinese said, okay, we're going to start allowing the currency to appreciate again, and it's moved since last June about 4% higher.
The accounts don't pay interest, so they only make money if the renminbi is ascendant. But Eichengreen does not believe the dollar is washed up. History shows the world can live with several of these coveted reserve currencies. His prediction, by 2020, the euro, the renminbi, and the dollar could all share the top spot. In New York, I'm David Brancaccio for Marketplace.
And you can check out David's Economy 4.0 blog at marketplace.org. Well, to Beverly Hills now, Steve, not far from where we sit.
Yeah.
There was a press conference yesterday to oppose the construction of a new 42,000-square-foot mega mansion there, just about the same size as your house.
Yeah, mine, exactly. Yeah.
Well, actually,
just a little smaller.
Actually, no, I think yours might be smaller because if you include the villa, the guest house, and the staff quarters, it's actually an 85,000-square-foot compound.
My residence would fit in the bathroom this house.
Either way, this place is going to dwarf LA's famous Griffith Observatory, as well as Aaron Spelling's house.
A huge gargantuan
thing.
That's right.
Although, in fairness, the someone associated with the project told the LA Times that it's just a normal Mediterranean-style house.
You know, I've been to the Mediterranean, yeah. And I haven't seen a house like
that
anywhere.
I don't think I've seen one that big yet. You're listening to the Midday Update for Wednesday, March 23rd in Los Angeles. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Steve Chiatakis. It was 1 year ago today President Obama signed health care reform into law. Since then, public opinion hasn't changed much, and a survey released by the Kaiser Family Foundation finds a majority of people are still confused by the law. It also says only slightly more people want to expand or keep the law than to repeal it or replace it with something else. Drew Altman is president of the Kaiser Family Foundation, and he's with us now. Good morning.
Good morning to you.
What was the overall message of these results?
There really has been no meaningful change. We still see half the American people for it and half the American people against it. I don't think we're going to see a lot of change until the major provisions of the law are implemented, the guts of the law. And that doesn't happen until 2014. The other big thing we see in public opinion is just confusion. So more than half of the American people tell us, you know, I just still can't figure this out. I'm still just very confused.
What part of the law do people like best?
The coverage expansions, the help people are going to get paying for their insurance policies, and the insurance reforms that eliminate the abuses in the insurance industry. They're more skeptical that the law will be helpful in terms of controlling overall healthcare costs in the country or helping them with their own healthcare costs.
What do people like least?
That's the issue of the individual mandate, which has been most hotly debated and which is the subject of court cases around the country. But I would add to that, that when people are told that the individual mandate only applies to people who don't have health insurance today, then opposition falls dramatically from almost 70% to only about a third.
And you mentioned a bunch of confusion about the law. Is this confusion because people just don't know? Do you think it's because of misinformation or just because it's so complicated?
People don't live in Washington, D.C., and they don't work on Capitol Hill or in the Department of Health and Human Services. And so it's really not the time when we should expect the American people to understand the details of the law. And they listen to a debate. And that's why even today, one third of seniors, and even a little bit more than that, still think that there are death panels in the law when there aren't. So there's a big burden on the media to be independent and try and make a judgment about what's important and what's political manipulation and not be manipulated itself and become part of the process. So I'll throw it back at you.
Drew Altman, president of the Kaiser Family Foundation. Drew, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Today, the FDA gets a final report from an advisory committee after a year-long review of the safety of menthol cigarettes. Menthols account for a third of U.S. cigarette sales, and the report is expected to give companies such as Lorillard, the maker of Newports, reason to breathe a sigh of relief. Here's Marketplace's Jennifer Collins.
Newport has been the menthol cigarette brand for decades.
Newport tastes fresher. Tastes better too.
A scientific advisory panel has studied whether that better taste makes menthols more addictive and thus more harmful. The panel's draft report says menthols are certainly harmful, but it didn't forcefully recommend pulling them from the market. Nick Modi is an analyst with UBS.
People are becoming even more comfortable with the fact that the FDA will not ban menthol.
Modi says the FDA may not want to strip the $5 billion in tax revenue menthols generate in the U.S., but
we don't think the companies are out of the woods just yet.
Patrick Hughes is with Height Analytics. He says this report doesn't fully vindicate Lorillard and other menthol cigarette companies.
We see FDA facing a very long road with extensive additional research required.
The FDA is expected to issue an update on menthols in the next 3 months. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
Steve, you know the New York Times is charging Canadian frequent users of its website.
Marketplace.org, by the way, is still free.
Marketplace.org is still free, but the New York Times is starting to charge. And in fact, on March 28th, they're going to be charging all of their users worldwide to use their online content. But it only took a Canadian hacker 1 week to figure out and publish a way to avoid paying for the New York Times online. Marketplace's Gregory Warner reports now on whether Times readers are really ready to pay up.
If you know how to install an extension on your internet browser, if those words even make sense to you, then you're nerdy enough to hack into the New York Times paywall and read articles online for free.
It's less about how nerdy a user is and more about how exposed he or she is to the work of other nerds.
This is Josh Benton, director of the Nieman Journalism Lab at Harvard. So what's the New York Times banking on, that its readers are just not smart enough or too underinformed? That's not...
Not very Timesian.
No.
And I think... The number of people who are going to decide, I want to create some sort of hack in my browser, is going to be pretty small. It's not going to be zero, but I think most people will make a decision to either pay up or just go to another website.
Because, and this is the guilt trip model that you, public radio listener, know well, people like to get their news for free, but they can sometimes be shamed into paying for it.
Shame or, you know, paying money for services because they value the content that the Times produces.
Could be the slogan for a New York Times pledge drive. I'm Gregory Warner bringing you this story at no extra charge on Marketplace.
And finally, Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez believes in aliens, Jeremy. Did you know this?
I did not know
You
that.
Did not know
no.
this. Well, I'm going to tell you more. He All even right. thinks there may have been life at one time on Mars.
Okay. Some right? people think that.
Some people do believe that, and even some scientists have
What does
have
he think
concluded.
Happened to the life on Mars?
Well,
Steve?
He made this speech the other day. How cold was it? In a speech marking World Water Day earlier this week, Chavez, who was an avowed socialist, of course,
right.
said the Red Planet could have had a civilization long, long ago.
Yep.
But he says when they adopted capitalism, the civilization died off.
That was the cause of it. There you go.
It was capitalism.
You know?
In Los Angeles, I'm Steve Chiatakis.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
And this is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.